For many of us, seeing the beauty in other people, being kind and compassionate towards other people, that comes pretty easily. But what's really hard is seeing the beauty in ourselves and being kind and compassionate consistently towards ourselves, especially when difficult things happen. Perhaps someone's critical of us, or we make a mistake. We beat up on ourselves. You could call it the inner critic, or that voice in the head that says mean things. Or you could call it self-hatred. What can we do in these circumstances to interrupt this cycle and learn to befriend ourselves consistently? Sounds True has created the Self-Acceptance Project to investigate this question. We've invited the participation of spiritual teachers, psychologists, neuroscientists, visionary writers, all to look at how can we learn to be kind and compassionate towards ourselves on a consistent basis. Thank you for joining us and welcome. This week features Robert Augustus Masters, a psychotherapist, group leader, body worker, and teacher of spiritual deepening practices. His audio program, Knowing Your Shadow, and his book, Emotional Intimacy, are both forthcoming from Sounds True later this year. So to begin with, Robert, as a psychotherapist who's worked with so many different clients, as well as working with people in groups, what's your sense of what the roots are of our collective challenge with self-acceptance?
I think part of the answer is to look at what we don't accept about ourselves with a compassionate eye. And this is quite a big step to turn toward and gaze with compassion upon these qualities of us that we tend to not feel very fond of. And what I found in my experience is that if we identify with the inner critic, that internalized shame voice we all have, we take its pronouncements the same way a child hears the authority in its parents' voices. Now, the first step is to be aware that this entity, this activity called the inner critic, does exist. And cannot think, well, I can get rid of it. I just meditate more, do more therapy. What I found, it doesn't go away. It just simply, we change our relationship to it. And once that happens, it's still there, but it doesn't bother us in the same way. It's like a mosquito in the room, so to speak.
Mosquitoes can be very bothersome at times.
They can be very irritating when they get very close. But let's say it's a mosquito in the back corner. And when it kicks in, what's very helpful is to name it as such, call it inner critic, for example, or another name. Then take a few breaths, soften the belly, step back from it, and observe the energy of it, the feel of it, as opposed to the context. The content is always critical, and it's critical. It's heartlessly critical. It's a negative appraisal of us, heartlessly negative appraisal. Once we register that, we stop trying to take into account what it's saying and believing in it. We step back and we feel the energy of it. We become more embodied, and then we might choose to speak to it. Previously to this, we've spoken from it, but when we speak to it, it makes a big difference. Suddenly, we are no longer a child looking up to a parent. We are on equal footing with this entity slash activity we call the inner critic.
Now, you've said something very interesting, which is this child role that we get in. Can you explain more about it? Is that some type of introject that the inner critic is like a critical parent and we go
well,
back
I think
to
that,
yeah.
Yeah, I think the sense of it for most of us is, is that the inner critic is speaking to a child. So, and we tend to turn into a child if we don't see it for what it is. And when we do that, we are usually tongue-tied. We are we're not doing so well, and the inner critic has the power, but it doesn't have the power inherently. It's because we give that away to it. Once we sense the dynamic between the inner critic and the child in us, the healing starts. We start to feel more intimate with the child, more protective of the child. But whereas prior to this, we would tend to look at the child in us through the eyes of the inner critic. So if the child in us is shy, shut down in some way, hurting, dysfunctional, we'll look upon that as with a sense of embarrassment, like we shouldn't be like that. We're adults. We've worked on ourselves. How can we regress like that? Of course, that's fuel for the inner critic. The inner critic would be saying, look at you. You're pathetic. How can you do this? You've worked on yourself so much. When we, as we really are, step into that, we silence the inner critic. We remove it, so to speak, from the battleground. And we move toward that child place in us, that locus of vulnerability, tenderness, softness, with a lot of care. We, in a sense, fall in love with that place in ourselves that is so pre-rational, so vulnerable, so little. And we all have it, whatever our age is. Once that happens, I think that brings out a sense of increased protectiveness in us, so that we're both embracing that child and protecting it. And in this, the inner critic takes a side, removed to the side, so to speak, quite a bit.
I'd be curious to know, Robert, in your own experience, I know you're quite a prolific writer. Was there a moment when you had a breakthrough in working with the inner critic yourself?
You know, and that's one area of my life where I have not been plagued by the inner critic. I write very spontaneously, fluidly. And the child in me loves to write. When I first began writing back in the 70s, I was a kind of shy person, but I would take my poetry and I would force the people in my households to listen to me read. And I would read this lurid, wild poetry. I just loved it. So I started off with a sense of just doing it from a very free place. But I can hear my inner critic speaking. Like, my inner critic kicked in when we started this conversation because of my throat and I couldn't speak very clearly. It was simply saying things to me about how I was letting you down, I wasn't doing a good job. And I heard it, stepped back a little bit, felt the child in myself, my vulnerability. And I started to feel the sense of all the people who are suffering more than I am, who hopefully will benefit from what we're doing here. And we'll start to be less harshly self-critical. I mean, I grew up with a very critical father. Extremely critical, very shaming, and I internalized that. And I entered my early adult years with that internalized shame going full blast, and I surrounded it with an armoring of aggression. So I was very athletic, very academically sharp, and it took some really painful experiences in my 20s to crack that. And when it did, the aggression was gone. It just was some anger and a lot of hurt, and there was shame. And I started to realize that shame is the emotion at the heart of the inner critic. I mean, we could say that healthy shame triggers our conscience, but unhealthy shame, toxic shame, triggers our inner critic. And our inner critic, unfortunately, for most of us, masquerades as our conscience. Like, it's a valuable voice. That's the impression that we get from when it's speaking with such authority. And really, if I hear an internal voice that lacks compassion, lacks heart, I don't take it seriously, usually. I notice that's, I'd rather shift my awareness to my breathing and do something more life-giving for myself.
Now, you've written a book on emotional intimacy, and in it you describe how we can become quote-unquote intimate with any emotion we might be experiencing. How does someone become intimate with shame when it arises?
The same as with any other emotion. Being intimate with that, any emotion or state, means that we get really close to it. Very close, but not so close that we lose focus, that we get absorbed in it. So if I'm getting close to my shame, I'm observing it very in detail. I can sense my history with it, what I'm about to do with it or not do with it. I see it very clearly. If I keep enough distance from it to keep it in focus, and that's the essence of intimacy, there's a certain connection, of course, is part of it, but also a certain separation is too. And so if I'm observing shame or fear in myself, I'm very slightly removed from it so I can observe it, but I'm also in it, excuse me, so closely that I can see it. I can see it in detail. I'm not detached from it. That's what intimacy is. So implicit in that, of course, is a lot of vulnerability. When we are really intimate with a state, emotion, another person, we're in a position where we can be hurt because we're in so close. And yet if we're not in that close, we miss out on so much.
Now, what you're saying is interesting to me, this idea of keeping a slight distance, because sometimes people talk about when there's a difficult emotion, fear or shame, to kind of go right into it somatically. But it sounds like you're describing to both do that and have an observer's perspective at the same
exactly.
time.
Exactly. So it's like the witness goes into that state deeply, plunges in, but there's a sense of that coexists with a deep participation in the experience. It's a bit like if you think of yourself as, you see a child has been badly hurt. Your heart goes out to that child, but if you get totally lost in his or her condition, you're not really going to be very helpful. If you keep a little bit of a distance, you can do the first aid, you call 911, comfort the child, help them deal with the shock. That's how I describe the way I work with people. And that's about intimacy, that you're in so close, you can't help but feel incredible empathy for that person. And yet, you have a subtle empathic wall so you can still function as an adult.
Now, how do you recommend people generate this quality of caring or compassion? Meaning, I can imagine someone saying, okay, I can be intimate with this terrible feeling, I can observe it, but I don't naturally feel this self-compassion. How do I get that on the scene?
Well, let's take fear. Fear is such a common emotion. It's painful for most of us and quite, you know, it is scary. When we get close to it, it's often helpful to personalize it as a distraught child, a very frightened child. So there's a sense of bringing our fear into our heart. That's the big step. And to do that, we have to have a willingness to turn toward what's difficult or painful or challenging in our lives. That's a huge step for us when that longing to be truly free becomes more central than the longing to keep distracting ourselves from our suffering. It's a huge step. It may seem very small when we're taking it, but even if you're millimetering along, you're moving toward the shame, the fear, the anger. You're getting to know it more. And when you do that, you sense that the younger you who's in the midst of that, the you who took on certain practices and behaviors around that emotion due to childhood circumstances. And there's a sense of bringing that child into our fully adult embrace and care and protection. And in that, when that happens, we may still be afraid, but we don't mind being afraid. And what I found, there's a subtle expansion occurs when we turn toward our fear, start to bring it into the heart. And that expansion causes the fear to cease being so fearful. It's like if you conceptualize a fear as a closed fist, imagine relaxing that hand, letting the hand soften and open. That's excitement. That's this in the sense of fear being excitement and drag. But this, none of this is possible if we don't cultivate intimacy with these difficult states. And when we do that, I think a natural compassion arises as we see the fearful us. When I see the fearful me or the ashamed me, my heart goes out to that one and to others who are suffering in a similar fashion. It's a natural thing.
Why do you think this turning towards our pain, which it sounds like you're saying is another way of talking about self-acceptance, Why do you think that's so difficult for people?
Because we've been conditioned to turn away from pain. We have an entire culture devoted to the avoidance of pain. In many ways, erotically, pharmaceutically, in all kinds of ways, our tendency, our default really is to, when pain arises, something uncomfortable, is to get away from it. So it seems counterintuitive at first to turn toward it. And when we turn toward it, then we have the opportunity to approach it and slowly enter. That means taking our conscious attention, our embodied attention into that state and observing that it's actually a fluxing process. It's not that scary when we get inside it. The hardest part is turning toward it.
Now, you've written a book, Robert, on spiritual bypassing. And part of what you talk about is how people use spirituality, quote unquote, as a way to actually avoid their pain, avoid their real experiences of pain.
And no big surprise there, because we tend to use other things in the same fashion. So when it comes to spirituality, here's this way of feeling much better in a hurry often. Wow, I can rise above my pain. I may even think it's not there, or I may confuse transcendence with dissociation. And there's a sense of just being somewhat removed from it. And that feels better. And we're still avoiding our pain in that, of course. And I think real spirituality is about making space for everything that we are to arise, and without any avoidance of it whatsoever. Now, that's very difficult to do if you don't have done some serious individual work, because sometimes what arises can be pretty heavy, pretty frightening.
What would you say is the litmus test for distinguishing between genuine transcendence and what dissociation, to use the term that you used, just splitting off, avoiding?
Well, in genuine transcendence, there's a sense of going beyond, but not excluding what has been gone beyond. And I think the key to that is, again, is intimacy. If we move past a certain stage of development, we remain intimate with the previous one, when it kicks in again, as it inevitably will, we know it from the, we know it so well, and we're not enamored of being beyond it. Plus, if we're really transcending something in a very healthy way, we get more grounded, more compassionate, more human. That's part of it. We become more full-bloodedly human. Our awakening is juicy, it's vital, it's embodied.
Now, one of the things I've noticed, and I'm curious what you have to say about this, is that one of the ways I can see how I'm not that accepting of myself is when I'm with somebody and something comes up in their experience. Maybe it's some experience of grief or rage or something that they're sharing with me. Mm-hmm. And I notice that I become quite mental instead of feeling and connecting in an intimate feeling way, and I start giving them advice, something like that. And I can tell that I'm not really there in the way that they need. I've shut down in some way. I'm curious what you think about that, how we sort of discover our own lack of self-acceptance.
Well, in that you're approaching them second. Here's the secondary reaction is to go upstairs, so to speak, and come from your head. But you probably learned that when you were younger. One way of getting away from painful feeling, once we hit our early teens, we can really get lost, absorbed in our rational minds, and seemingly present something of value, like here's some great advice. But what we're missing there, of course, is connecting empathetically with that person, feeling their grief, their discomfort, their shame. I think when that happens, when we give ourselves permission to feel that person, we can still keep a little bit of distance, so we're not flooded by their state, like some people do who are too empathetic. But still, I think the key is to have compassion for the fact that you have that difficulty. Notice if your inner critic is giving you a hard time about it, and just tell it in whatever language you want to just back the hell off, while you shift your awareness down to your heart, your belly, your legs, and get more grounded, and perhaps even letting that person know that you're making a transition from your headquarters, your mental headquarters, to your heart and your guts, and you're a little sorry you're not connecting with them more. That often helps, because then in that you become very vulnerable, and that vulnerability is contagious. It brings them forward more in theirs, and they feel more like you're with them. But to do that effectively, you can't allow yourself to be detoured by shame or some subtle embarrassment that you're not able to soften enough to do that. Sometimes we can't soften enough. Sometimes my work is to open my heart to my closed-heartedness. In other words, to have compassion for the places in me that don't give a damn about what you're feeling or anyone else, that are very self-centered, narcissistic. It's in all of us. So when I talk about my work, becoming intimate with all that we are, that means everything. And there's some really painful, dark, embarrassing things in each of us. So when I touch those in myself and approach them, invariably there's a sense of them shifting from being a disowned or rejected it to reclaimed me. In other words, I become more whole through the process. And once that's done enough, it becomes second nature to turn toward what's difficult, unpleasant, etc.
Now, this is very interesting, opening our heart to our own closed-heartedness. Can you say more about how one actually does that? How do you do it?
By, first of all, acknowledging that we are close-hearted or feeling aversion to another person or distaste, disgust, whatever it is, admitting that without any judgment. Just here it is. Here's the truth. I feel disgust about this. I feel closed about that. And then looking at that quality in us through the eyes of something other than our inner critic. So the inner critic has to be pushed aside for that to happen. Once that happens, you'll see there's Robert, there's Tammy behaving in an immature or disconnected fashion. And when I sense that, my heart automatically goes out to that because I can sense the younger me in that, or you might sense the younger you in that. When we were younger, we got hurt, misunderstood. And instead of repeating that by pulling away from that part of ourselves as seemingly messed up, it's like taking a frightened child and holding them close and not telling them everything's going to be okay or there's nothing wrong with you. It's more like just being with them, presence to presence. And I find in our deepest, deepest primal traumatic work with people is there's always a big point of that in them, which is pre-rational, totally vulnerable, maybe even from infancy, being brought into the room and held cradled by whoever's there. That's a huge step.
Now, I'm curious to know a little bit more when you talk about how we're supposed to talk or how we have an opportunity to talk to our inner critic, if you could give me a few more pointers on that.
Well, here's one dramatic example I just thought of. I had a client some years ago who was suicidal because her inner critic had a constant megaphone. It was so loud, so forceful, and so mean-spirited. It wasn't just the typical one. This was vicious. And of course, it's exactly the way one of her parents spoke to her when she was a little girl. And she'd internalized that, but she believed it. And we did a bunch of deep work around it. And then suddenly she sat up and she looked at me and she started to scream, "I am not you." But she was talking to the inner critic. It was very clear to me that this was happening. "I am not you. I am not you." And she did it. And then she started to stand up and almost dance. She got it. It sank into her. "I am not you. I am not the inner critic. This isn't something. It's an implant. It's a souvenir of a bad childhood." She took it in. And it changed her life because she got, this is not who I am. And you and I and everyone else have to do the same sort of thing, is recognize this is not me. This is an internalized voice. It's pretty unpleasant. It certainly can sound very convincing at times, but there's no heart. It's a heartlessly negative appraisal of us. And when we see that, we can say no to it. And the key is to withdraw attention from the inner critic. When you withdraw attention from this process we call the inner critic, you're not under its sway anymore. You're not under its thumb. You're not no longer a child responding to a difficult parent. You're simply an adult, a healthy being, relating skillfully to an aspect of yourself that's not so healthy. Mm-hmm. So a lot of this, Tammy, is about learning to relate to these qualities. And again, we come back to intimacy, because intimacy is like the poetry of relationship. It's the key essence of it. So when I relate to these different qualities, they don't go away, but they don't bother me. I don't mind. I think I've said to you before, when I was much younger, I had the ambition I'd get rid of all these things in myself I thought weren't healthy, and I meditated like a maniac in my 30s. And excuse me. And then I realized that all these meditative experiences, all these incredible states I could enter, didn't change me at all. I still was the same insufferable person. And it was a shock when I woke up one day and got that. And at that point, I realized my work was to learn how to relate to these qualities and realize they may stay with me forever. There's no guarantee they're going to be gone just because I don't want them there, or I can do a meditative practice that makes me feel like they're not around. So I don't mind my anger. I don't mind my fear. I don't mind my so-called bad qualities or neuroses. I just don't let them run the show. They're like kids that sit in the back seat while I drive. But they play, and the inner critic is there buzzing around, the mosquito, and each of us, to me, is like a collection of, or an assembly or a community of selves. And our job is to be the space that can hold them all and in the way that creates a deeper wholeness.
I think the question that comes up as I'm listening to you is, who is the driver of the car?
That's the mystery of who we really are. That's the what you, if you ask the question, who or what am I, seriously enough, you come up with the answer. It's often not a verbal answer. It's a sense of this is the ground of being, but somehow it's mysteriously individualized. It's not just this kind of depersonalized spirituality. There's a sense of here's the essential Tammy or the essential Robert. And within that field of sentient presence, there's all the other elements that constitute you or me. Gender, job occupation, different pieces of us, who I was when I was a baby, who you were when you're a little girl. It's all in there. And it's a lovely thing to feel like nothing gets excluded from that community. We all get, everything in it is part of me or part of you. And when we do that, we start to feel intimate with the human race because we're all in the same boat, needing to shift from fragmentation to wholeness.
No, it's interesting. There are a lot of non-dual teachers who will take that question, what is the self? And they'll talk about it as this quote-unquote ground of being, but they won't necessarily make the second point you made, that there's somehow an individualized sense, an essential Robertness in this ground of being. And I'm curious to hear you say more about that.
Well, that essential Robertness or essential Tamminess is not our egoity. It's not the ego-centered dimensions of ourselves. It's our uniqueness. I mean, no one's ever been born who's exactly like you or like me. We're each a unique flowering here for just a short time and hopefully blooming fully. And in that, I think we get to bring together our true nature and our everything else we are is a sense of wholeness. I have a poem I wrote once that goes, we are light and we are darkness, and we are the flesh, be it of mud or stars, torn between the two, yet already the one, inseparable from the broken many. And the key lines for me are the last ones, inseparable from the broken many. And I think many of us can get caught up in spirituality in a way where we dissociate from the pain of others. And the path I've chosen is the opposite, is to let myself feel that as much as possible without getting lost in it. And in that, I find my work goes deeper. I can feel myself being of more service. And what's self-critical in me at that point does not run the show at all.
Now, you've mentioned this word intimacy a few different times, and I know that intimate relationship is something that's important to you and important in your work.
Yes.
And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about how you think our ability to accept ourselves fully and wholly can be facilitated through loving, intimate relationships.
Well, I think a loving, intimate, committed relationship creates a kind of sanctuary wherein everything that's neurotic in us and our partner can surface and be worked with, gazed at in a sense by the mutually compassionate eye of both of us. Here's the stuff that I need to work on, my partner needs to work on, and we have a sanctuary. We have enough safety to do that, to be that vulnerable and that raw. And unfortunately, many of us are in relationships where we don't have enough safety for that. So we do a lot of therapy and try and find it with friends. But if you have a partner you trust profoundly, he or she has earned your trust, miracles can happen. I mean, I feel absolutely blessed to be with Diane. We have an uncommonly close bond. And sometimes it's difficult for me because everything in me that surfaces, sometimes I don't want things to surface, but they do. And when they do, there she is gazing at them with such care and such presence, and also with enough challenge to make sure that I do my work with it and don't just kind of slip to one side. So in a sense, in a truly intimate relationship, there's no escape. There's a sense of finding freedom through the limitation of it.
Mm-hmm. So say more about that last part, the freedom through limitation.
Well, I see that. So let's say we can look at it in terms of, say, monogamy, a healthy, conscious monogamy. It may seem very limiting to some people because it's just two people. But within that, within the context of that dyad, there's enormous freedom. Enormous freedom. And the limits themselves set a certain boundary, but within that is boundless. For example, I can be with Diane and sense in her archetypal femaleness as well as her wonderful individuality all at the same time. And whatever in me needs to be brought to the surface, comes up, is gazed upon, worked with. Not that we spend a lot of time doing that. Most of our time is pretty loose, easy, and happy. But there's this permission. And it doesn't. There's a sense that this doesn't go away as we get older, that we are evolving and deepening. As, you know, I'm 65, she's almost 62. There's such a joy in going forward in this and sensing we have a sanctuary together, and we also are co-creating a crucible. There's a lot of heat, and that heat is wonderful. I mean, fire is heat, and it's also light. I mean, I could wax on and on about relationship because it's such a passionate topic for me, but...
Well, I actually want to circle back here as we end our conversation to the beginning, and I want to go back to this idea of someone who's working with their inner critic. And let's say for this person, it's not a mosquito that's in the corner of the room, you know, quietly sleeping and occasionally buzzing a little bit, but that it seems like it turns into this quite big mosquito, like the person you said that you worked with who was almost suicidal. She was so, you know, so beaten by this inner critic.
Yes.
How would you help this person shrink this inner critic to its proper size and get in the back seat of the car, to use your metaphor?
Well, part of what needs to happen initially is getting a clear sense of the history this person has with, like, who in their past did this to them. Is their inner critic a reflection of one parent or the other, or is it a composite of parents, perhaps a sibling, older sibling that was very harsh, teachers? And getting a sense of that, talking about it, educating them about what the inner critic is, that it's not a thing in us, it's a process, it's a noun, it's a verb, not a noun, it's an act. And to teach about it, and then to start to work with the history. If that person was overwhelmed by a very angry parent who's shaming them, part of the work is to get them in touch with their anger. Because if you have your anger on tap, you can say no to the inner critic. If you don't have your anger on tap, your no could be either not there or be very anemic. So there's a sense of getting in touch with one's anger, male or female, and learning to take stands. Because the inner critic is not just constituted by shame, there's also aggression in it. And aggression, to me, is an unhealthy form of anger. Anger is a vulnerable emotion. Anger, when it becomes aggression, is just out to attack. The inner critic is out to attack. So once the person has a sense of all this, then we can start to have them talk to the inner critic. That's like in a gestalt situation where the inner critic's on one chair, person's on the other chair, they go back and forth, a dialogue begins. And initially a person often will speak in a very tiny voice to the inner critic, but with proper encouragement, that person will eventually start to speak more from their guts, will take firmer stands, will say no, will say stop. And as they do this, when they play the inner critic, it becomes weaker. And they start to realize, my God, it's big and scary because I give it my power. I'm giving it my attention. I'm going to starve it. I'm going to withdraw my attention and energy from it.
It's very interesting that you brought up this idea of healthy anger in getting the inner critic down to its proper size and placement. I never thought about that before. How did you come to that?
It just came to me. Mm-hmm. I'm writing about this stuff left, right, and center, you know, from my new book, Emotional Intimacy. I never thought that much about the aggression and the inner critic, but I realized it's a major, major player. And what's needed there is to understand that anger is a natural, healthy emotion. It's a vulnerable emotion. It's a relational emotion. It's a moral emotion. But when it becomes aggression, if I'm aggressive toward you or anyone else, I just want to attack you, put you down, find your weak spots, And many of us revert to that, say when we're in relational hassles, we'll, our anger will morph into aggression. And the key is not to not get angry. The key is to shift the aggression back into anger. Because when you're in anger and it's clean, there's a sense of vulnerability. If I'm angry at you and I'm fiery and I'm hot, I'm still going to feel some degree of caring for you, and you're going to feel that. And that will make you feel safer with me because I'm not just trying to knock you down. I'm just simply trying to underline something that's important to me.
Now, I just want to go a little bit further understanding this. This line where anger turns into aggression, what's that line?
The line is where we lose all caring for the other person. There's zero compassion, and we shift from trying to get through about something that's important to us to simply being there to attack. And once we've done that, we've lost touch with the vulnerability and the relational component of anger. We're just out to get the other person. And shame ties in here too, because when we feel shame and we want to get away from it because it feels so damned unpleasant, we'll often let it, it seems automatic to us usually, but we'll let it shift into aggression or dissociation or withdrawal. And the aggression can either be towards other people or towards ourselves, but it is aggression. The inner critic is internalized aggression coming our way, which is very similar to the aggression we can have when we go after someone else, when we become hypercritical of them. And unfortunately, for many of us on spiritual paths, many people will think that if they're angry, they're not spiritual, they've regressed. And a lot of Buddhist texts, for example, will use the same word to translate ill will, hatred, and aggression as anger. So there's a sense of anger is considered an unwholesome emotion in Buddhism. It's one of the seven deadly sins in Christianity. So it's gotten a lot of bad press. A lot of my work is to revision anger so that it becomes seen as a resource. And then the question is how to skillfully use it.
Yeah, I've never thought of anger as being an emotion that had vulnerability in it. I'm still not sure I get that.
Well, if it's healthy, say you're angry at a dear friend. Yeah. And if you feel sad, if you let some tears come as you're being angry and you feel some caring for him or her, even though you're really pissed at them, they're going to feel safer than if you're just cleverly lambasting them from your headquarters. So if you're vulnerable in your anger with another, they feel more at ease. They may still feel a little scared because you're being quite intense. I call this the heart anger. The highest level for me of anger is heart anger. It means fully expressed anger coexisting with some degree of compassion for the other person.
And what you're saying is that in dealing with our inner critic, it's this type of heart anger that we need, not aggression?
Yeah, ideally. And to get to heart anger, we have to start with just regular anger and just have some remembrance that you care about this person that you're angry at. You don't have to tone it down very much or not have an angry face, but you simply are letting them know non-verbally that you're still with them. You're just bothered by what they've done, and you're going after the behavior, not the person. It's just like with healthy and unhealthy shame. Healthy shame, we go after the behavior. We shame the person for that or ourselves. Unhealthy shame, we're going after the person. We're actually bringing their very being onto the carpet and trying to crush them.
Now, one other thing you said, Robert, that I want to unpack a little bit. You talked about how the inner critic is actually a verb, not a noun. And I think a lot of people think of their inner critic, maybe they'll give the inner critic a name, and it feels more like it's a living, you know, companion in the house versus a verb. What do you have to say to that?
Well, it's a personified verb. I mean, because it involves, it's not just this thing in us. See, we often conceive of our emotions the same way, like they're these endogenous masses, these things within that we can just simply get out of our system. We can vent them. Not true, because emotion is not just feeling. It's feeling, cognition, social factors, our conditioning. And the inner critic is a kind of a conglomerate, too. There's a lot of emotion in it. There's a lot of cognition. So it's a process. It's a verb. But it's fine to personify it with a name, to say, okay, call your inner critic, say, Bill or John or Mary, or inner critic. We often have people in groups all name their inner critic, then take maybe a minute each just speaking as though they are their inner critic and exaggerating it. It can be quite revealing, because it's amazing how cruel so many people's inner critics are when they're allowed to speak out in the open.
And just one final question here, Robert. You talked about what it might be like to shift the energy to our heart at a certain point in working with ourselves, that there's a shift we can make. I'd like to know how you do that. How do you actually take whatever's going on? You're in your quote-unquote headquarters, as you say. How do you move the energy into your heart?
Shift your attention to that zone. Shift your attention literally to your chest. Breathe into it. Soften the belly. That really helps have the gut soft. And just keep some awareness there. And have a sense of, once you've done that for a few minutes, then bringing into that a younger version of yourself. This is a very helpful way to do this. There's other ways, of course, but to bring in that younger version of Tammy or Robert and sense, there you are, you're a little girl, you're scared, you're frightened, you're ashamed, and you bring that into your heart, that one, and just breathe into that and don't let your mind kind of say, oh, this is silly, I shouldn't be doing this, I should be beyond this, but just to simply be with it. And this causes a softening. In the heart area, the shoulders, the face, there's a sense of reclaiming something that we think we should have outgrown, but that actually is with us right through our entire lives, our innocence, our vulnerability, our pre-rational self.
I've been speaking with Robert Augustus Masters as part of the Self-Acceptance Project. Robert, thank you so much for bringing your voice and your insights to this investigation.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Augustus Masters. Oh, please go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I'm so grateful the frog in my throat didn't assert itself too much during our conversation.
No, it was like an insect in the back
yeah,
of the room.
It was. It kind of joined the mosquitoes a little bit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Robert Augustus Masters is the author of a new book on emotional intimacy, as well as a Sounds True audio learning series on knowing your shadow. And if you're interested to know more, both about the Self-Acceptance Project and everything that we have to offer at Sounds True, free podcasts, downloadable programs, online courses and events, as well as music and books that we publish and our annual Wake Up Festival, please visit us often at soundstrue.com. Many voices, one journey. Thanks for listening.